Welcome to Conversations from the Pale Blue Dot.
Today I interview philosopher and theologian David Basinger.
I've been doing some work on brain theory and how the brains, probably for good evolutionary reasons, is such that if you hold a belief firmly and it came to you, especially early in life, those beliefs that seem normal and natural to you, your brain will defend them at all costs.
Remember to visit commonsenseatheism.com for more episodes and articles about God, science, and morality.
Dr. David Basinger is a professor of philosophy at Robert's Wesleyan College and is particularly known for his work on open theism and on miracles. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Luke. I'm happy to have this opportunity to talk with you.
Well, David, let's start with open theism. What is open theism and what are some of its varieties?
I guess to put it most simply, open theism is recent, I think increasingly influential conceptualization of God and how God relates to the world. And that really centers around four aspects of God's nature: power, knowledge, moral nature, and emotive nature. So I'll say just a bit about each of those. With respect to God's power, there are three basic categories. There's theological determinism, which says that God has decreed all and controls all. So God has decreed from the beginning of time who will win the NBA championships. God decreed from the beginning of time the Holocaust would occur. And so in that sense, it's the best of all possible worlds, as Leibniz said. Free will theism is a view that says that God has as much power as the God of theological determinism, but God has chosen not to intervene directly when God gives people freedom of choice. So to the extent that God has given individuals freedom of choice, then God is self-limited that way. And then you have process theism, which says, in essence, that God isn't metaphysically able to intervene unilaterally. Open theists are free will theists. So open theists believe that God has chosen to give people freedom, and to the extent to which God allows that freedom to be actualized, then God has given up control. With respect to knowledge, there are three perspectives: present knowledge, simple foreknowledge, and middle knowledge. So let's just assume, for example, that Jim's thinking about marrying one of three individuals. And he goes to God, and we'll just beg the question about whether God could communicate to Jim in this case. He goes to God for information. If God has present knowledge, then God would know with respect to each of those women exactly what their motives were and what their intentions were. God would know their personalities. God wouldn't know what would happen necessarily in the future if Jim married any one of them. If God has simple foreknowledge, then God would know what would happen, which one he would marry and what would happen. God wouldn't know what would have happened if Jim had married other people. If God has middle knowledge, then God knows what would have happened if in each case. Open theists believe in present knowledge, and that's been the most controversial claim, and that is that God doesn't know the future infallibly. So we can say more about that later. With respect to God's moral nature, the question would be whether God is always trying to do the best within God's power to make our lives as good as possible. Many classical theists thought the answer to that was no. Romans 8 and 9, for example, sort of gives the understanding that we're here for God, God's not here for us, God can do whatever God wants with us for God's purposes. The other view says that no, God is within the limits of freedom and other aspects, trying always to do what's best for us, and open theists affirm that last component. And then with respect to God's emotive nature, the question would be, does God have, analogically speaking, some kind of emotion? Does God respond to what happens in this world? Historically, many Orthodox theists believed in immutability and impassibility, so God couldn't have emotion. But the other view says that God does feel and respond to what's happening in our world, and open theists would respond to that. So open theists believe that God has all the power that's possible but has chosen not to utilize it, and that God doesn't know what's going to happen infallibly in the future, that God is out to help us to the extent possible, that God feels and interacts with us, and that's why it's open, because the future is really open. God's interacting with us in time. So I think maybe that's the best way of showing what all open theists agree on.
And then, do open theists affirm the three traditional infinities of God, the perfect goodness, the perfect power, and the perfect knowledge?
Yes, they do. And all those terms, to go back to even Aquinas and others, if we take perfect power as being all the power that God has displayed or utilized in the most perfect way, then open theists say yes, because God has all the power that any God could have, and a God that chooses not to always utilize that power and to give us freedom, if it's a self-limitation, then it's not a limitation on God's power, and it's a more perfect use of that power. So they say yes to that. They define omniscience, or omniscience is often defined as God knows everything that can be known, and open theists would say that what people will freely do in the future is does not exist, therefore it can't be known, and therefore God is still omniscient. And they would say, too, that perfect goodness, again, that God cares for us and feels with us, is the best manifestation of perfect goodness. So open theists would say, yes, we do affirm those traditional attributes, understood differently than they have been in the past.
And I think maybe one of the major ones for people is God's lack of foreknowledge, but that has more to do with the open theist concept of time than it does the concept of God.
Well, I think that's true in part. It has to do with the fact that, again, the open God is not a timeless God. And we have to be careful here, because open theists wouldn't want to say that God is sort of bound by, I would say, sort of human psychological understanding of time. That wouldn't be it. I guess open theists would say something like this with respect to timeless, that if you're going to take language about God seriously at all, and you're going to believe that God does act in the world, for example, and make decisions, then if there's not sequencing of thought in God's mind in some way, then it's hard to understand what actual meter sequencing would be or decision-making would be. So open theists would talk about God being everlasting. Nick Wolderstorff and others have talked about this, the concept that not that God sort of thinks as humans think in time, but that certainly there must be some sequencing, because if you get the God of Boethius and others sitting on the hill looking down and watching everything, that's a very nice Aristotelian understanding of how things are, but it's hard to get God in the action that way.
And then what are some of the motivations for open theism? Some of it comes from a concern about the coherence of traditional notion of God, right?
I think that's true, and I think... for example, open theists such as, I'd say Bill Hasker is a good friend of mine who's an open theist, and the idea that infallible divine knowledge and human freedom are incompatible. So we're talking today, and if God knew 10 years ago, 10,000 years ago, 10 million years ago that we were going to talk today, then we will talk today, or God's not, or we could decide, we could by our decisions today make it such that God had a false belief. That's not possible. So we can't really choose differently, so we aren't free. And that strikes about half the philosophy of religion I know as a pretty strong argument. And therefore, it's led them toward the more open view with respect to God's knowledge. But I would say probably as important as that has been a different understanding of sort of the biblical record and for the Christian open theists, what the Bible has to say. I think more and more there's a feeling on the part of some people that traditional Orthodox theology is sort of the Bible viewed through the lens of either the Aristotelian lens of Thomas or the Platonic lens of Augustine, and what you get really is Greek philosophy more than biblical understanding. So once you put that away and look differently, so, for example, Richard Rice, who's a proponent of open theism and actually in the openness of God, wrote the first chapter, would say, if you look at the number of times God repents and changes God's mind, which I think is about 20 or something like that, you get a much different view. You get a God who really reacts to what's happening in time. So I think there's the consistency philosophically, and then there's also the feeling that it's a better understanding of what the Bible's saying.
I was surprised in reading a bit on open theism that it's apparently a very new view. And a lot of what you're saying just seems to make, it sounds very plausible to me from a theological point of view, but apparently it's something that came about in the 80s, or do I have my history wrong?
It's new and it's not new. So with respect to what's called open theism today, it actually came about in the 90s. In 1992, five of us, Clark Pinnock and Bill Hasker and John Sanders and Richard Rice and I were out in San Francisco at an American Academy of Religion meeting and just talking about our understanding of some of these things, and decided to put some of these views together. So I would say the idea of free will theism has been around since the beginning of theological discussions. And it's so that's not new. The idea of God having an emotive nature, that's, I think, probably the predominant view now, and the idea of God's moral nature, that God cares for us, is predominant. So, in essence, those three factors were there. When you put that together with present knowledge, that's what was new. And new within the context of people who never thought that was possible. So that wouldn't have been new for process theists, that wouldn't have been new for relational theists, idealists, all sorts of people like that. But within what might be considered Orthodox Christian circles, the claim that God doesn't know the future infallibly was almost heretical, and actually some people lost their jobs over that in some schools. So in that sense, it's sort of an intramural debate. So so oddly enough, it started, I think, sort of in a small circle. It might be called conservative Christian circles, or even evangelical circles, although I'm not an evangelical myself. But you know what, I play in that sandbox to some extent. So that's what really caught the attention. I think because the people who put it forth were claiming the same authority of Scripture and same hermeneutic as those who had just assumed automatically that God knew the future, it got people's attention. And once that happened, right, then it sort of took off. And then because some of us, for example, also are involved, for example, Bill Hasker and I are involved in two Oxford texts. One's a reader and one's an regular text on philosophy of religion. We put that in as a concept. So it's been sort of picked up now in philosophical circles as an interesting concept. So in that sense, it's sort of grown. But you're right, the components themselves, none of them, not one of them would be considered new. It's the configuration in the context that made it, I think, new in that sense.
What are some of the best arguments from the Christian critics of open theism, and what are your responses?
Let me preface that by just making a general claim that I'll come back to later about epistemological stance on this. When you make a claim, it seems to me you can say, I believe something in two ways. You can say, I affirm this belief, and only my perspective is justifiable, and therefore the implication is, or the consequence is, others who have different beliefs either aren't knowledgeable or aren't sincere. So you have that perspective. Then you have a perspective that would say, I affirm this belief strongly, I feel justified in doing that, but other people who hold different beliefs are equally knowledgeable and sincere, and therefore equally justified. I'm in the latter category. There are very polemic, there are very strong open theists who would want to argue that open theism is the truth, and say nicely and kindly that people don't agree, just either the lack of knowledge or a lack of sincerity or something is going on there. In my perspective, and I've argued in a lot of different contexts, apart from even religious discussions, that as long as perspectives are self-consistent and comprehensive, then there could be a number of equally justifiable perspectives, and one has to choose them on the basis of one's own criteria as to which one is most satisfying. So that's sort of the background. So I'm not what you'd call a very polemic open theist, and I want to say it that way because I teach classes on open theism, and the critics seem to me to be justified in their perspective overall. However, I do disagree with some of the criticisms raised, but let me raise what I see as the three most important ones and say how I respond. So one would be that creation under open theism becomes a gamble and life is very risky. Now, anybody who believes in even free will theism would have to grant that to the extent that God gives people freedom, then there's going to be some risk in the world. But there's been some comfort in the minds of people who believe in simple foreknowledge or middle knowledge, and that is at least God knew up front what was going to happen. And when God created, God had some idea that the risk would turn out this way. With open theism, isn't it the case that there's even more risk? And I think the answer probably is yes. But having said that, there are a number of people who find that very exciting. I've written lots of things, and mostly I get responses in journals or something happens. When the openness of God came out, I got dozens of calls and letters, and many of them were very positive, people saying, I always thought this felt like the right way of looking at theology, this kind of openness. I can live better with a risk than I can with some God who planned this or knew what was going to happen in that way. So, but I understand, and I talk about this with students in classes all the time, and it certainly is the case for some people. This goes against what they really thought they were getting when they affirmed God, and that was control. You go to bed at night and you say, thank goodness it all fits in some plan, and if you're an open theist, that isn't the case. So I think that's fair to say that some people will just find that unsettling.
That objection almost sounds like a I don't like it objection rather than a it's not true because.
Right. Yeah, I put it in that category, but I don't want to minimize that because, as I said before, I think ultimately reason itself and rational consideration, I don't believe, is going to resolve these kinds of metaphysical issues. I think reason can show inconsistencies within systems and give us reason to think about things, but ultimately it seems to me that when we come down to some of the major issues and of life, one of them being this religious or non-religious perspective, there is some sort of picture preference there in some way. So I clearly don't want to be heard as saying that somehow how you feel about that is all that matters. But I do think that ultimately equally sincere, knowledgeable people see these things differently. And whether it strikes you and you're going to affirm it in one sense is going to be how it relates to your life. So you're right. This is simply a criticism that says it feels, I don't feel comfortable with this. That's not, I don't think, a criticism against open theism itself. It's just as a reason maybe why some people don't find it very appealing. Second objection would be this a similar one as the first one, and that has to do with divine guidance. The idea, again, most of my students have never heard about middle knowledge, but my Christian students have just almost always presupposed not just that God knows the future, because that's just crystal ball help. That's just interest. Most of them really do believe that God has available comparative knowledge. So you're thinking about different people to marry, different schools to go to. God can sort of look down each path and see what would happen if. And that's powerful knowledge if that were there. And I think they presuppose that in some way when they pray and ask for guidance. So the idea of seeing that with a God with the present knowledge, that's not going to be possible. As a matter of fact, that God couldn't even say for sure what was going to happen. That becomes, again, very frightening to some people. And it takes away something they thought was one of the key important points about being a theist or a Christian. But that's just of the same kind as the first. The third one is the one I think is by far the most important criticism. Again, when I teach class on open theism, I always try to make sure that the best arguments of all sides are heard. And that would be the one I think about prophecy in some way, because it does appear on the surface that if you presuppose that, let's say, in the Bible there are prophetic utterances about what's going to happen in the future, and then you believe, as open theists do, that God is self-limited and doesn't control what people freely do, then it's hard to see how God could ahead of time say with certainty that something was going to happen that way. And some of those, I think, can be answered very easily by saying things like, many prophecies are conditional. If this happens, then that will happen, and that's not a predictive prophecy, that's just a conditional prophecy that way, that I will do this, God says, if certain people do that. Open theism is not process theism. Critics always want to conflate the two, because open theism doesn't say that God can't unilaterally intervene at some point. And back to open theism itself, there are varieties here, because the extent to which God has chosen not to intervene can differ from open theist to open theist. So, and that would, then we can come back to that if we want, but that would affect prayer, evil, miracle, all those sorts of things, because that all plays a bound of extent to which God could have intervened and didn't, or why God didn't, and that sort of thing. So we have that sort of thing. So some prophecies could be made, and God could simply bring them about. I would say probably, and I was just thinking about this again, preparing for this discussion, the type of verse that would be most complicating for open theism would be a verse, or the verses that would say something about, let's take Jesus saying, before dawn, Peter, you will have denied me three times. Now, that would seem to presuppose that God not only knew there'd be some denial, and that you could know that from simply Peter's temperament or something like that, but how many times and that sort of thing. So the critic would often say, that's probably the verse they use most frequently. And in response to that, I think that's a decent criticism in some ways on the surface. I mean, there's always an easy way out, because any system can remain self-consistent by just simply raising something. So you could say something like, well, if the point is to sort of show Peter that he isn't who he thought he was, God could have simply made it the case that something was brought up in such a way that God knew Peter would have to deny, because God knew Peter's nature. So God could have manipulated. That's one possibility, which sort of goes against the tenet, again, too, that God lets people decide freely. I think probably the two responses that would be used most frequently, one would be the whole idea of what's the hermeneutic here of understanding what the Bible's really trying to say. So if you make the distinction between inspiration, which would be a decision about God's authority, and interpretation of what's meant, and you make that clearly as Bacon and others did, then you could say you don't know from the words exactly how literally to take this. So, for example, there are two creation stories. So clearly, you wouldn't want to say that the words of Genesis 1 and 2 are literally true, because then we have a contradiction in some ways with respect to the timing and sequencing. So you'd want to say something like, as many theists today do or Christians, that the point is God created exactly how it would be up for grabs somehow. Or Exodus 32, where Moses is up there doing whatever Moses is doing, and God looks down and sees Aaron and the others fooling around, gets very angry, and wants to and says, "Get out of my way, Moses, I'm going to go destroy those people." And Moses sort of says, "Calm down, God, what would the neighbors think? You can't handle your own people," and all that sort of thing. That's often been thought of as not literally true, but saying something from a human perspective, how it might have appeared. Well, once you get into that game, and every Christian plays that game to some extent, then you can ask the question of how literally true that story about Peter was. What's the concept there? And the concept was that Peter wasn't who Peter thought Peter was, and in when push came to shove, wouldn't follow through. So there's that sort of thing. Or the one I would just choose, though, because when I talk about this in various areas, I guess if you take the Bible as some kind of authoritative book, you're simply going to find on almost every important issues verses that on the surface, a prima facie reading would be incompatible with other verses, whether you're talking about God's predestining or giving freedom or whatever it would be. I guess a standard old hermeneutical principle would be not just in the Bible, but the Quran or any kind of book is you have to sometimes interpret some verses in terms of themes you find throughout. So I guess that would be the way to respond to that. But I think that's a valid question. That's a valid criticism. And open theists at that point, I think, have to play the game that everybody plays sometime. And you sort of say, I have ways of responding to that, which are going to seem to the critic to be ad hoc. It's going to seem as if you just made them up to stay consistent that way.
That's interesting. I thought of another potential response or defense that could be offered by the open theist to the objection from prophecy, and that would be, I'd like to hear from you if this would be open to the open theist. The open theist could say, well, there are lots and lots of unfulfilled prophecies in the Bible, so maybe God is, you know, pulling the same trick that Nostradamus did and just giving a whole lot of prophecies, and then some of them come true, and obviously, and then a whole bunch of them.
Some theists would be uncomfortable saying that God just gave a whole bunch of predictions, but I don't see anything in principle that would be problematic with saying that in some ways. And I think you could even look at texts in the Bible that would give some support for that sort of thing. I'll just make one last comment on open theism, and that would be, it seems to me, I was just at a conference, a very interesting conference, on an international conference on Islam, salvation, and the fate of the other. And I was one of the few non-Islamic people there speaking at that conference. And it just struck me when I was talking to some of the Islamic scholars in the philosophy of religion, how when I would share with them the tenets of open theism, they would say, yeah, there are certainly Islamic believers and scholars who believe those things. So in one sense, open theism isn't just, I don't think, it ended up being, I would say, you know, something that really came about in a rather small, conservative, evangelical, Protestant context almost. But it's grown, and I think the concept is something that is probably there in various religions. And if you would have been there, I know your background a little bit from what I've seen online, and you would have heard the discussion about Islam, salvation, and the fate of the others. If you would have heard that and what was said, there was higher criticism. And then there was one person that got up, a really sharp young person who's finishing his work at Yale, who just got up and finally then just sort of gave a testimony and said, well, you know, it all comes down to when you read the book, you just know it's true. And you've been in 100 testimony meetings in your life in conservative Christian circles. I've been there. And it was just amazing. You could have simply changed from Islam to Christianity, and all the discussion was the same. And the passions were the same.
Oh, yeah.
The players were the same. And that was just, you know that, but to experience it, I found that just fascinating.
Christians are the ones who are doing all of the intellectual defense of theism right now, but whenever Muslims feel like it, they can just go in and cross out God and replace it with Allah, and it'll work.
Yeah, and to be honest, the kind of things that I really end up doing, and lately I've been working in religious diversity and intellectual humility and stuff like that, and the kind of things I do, they cross over very easily.
Well, then let's talk about miracles.
Sure.
Any talk of miracles usually begins with Hume. What did Hume say about miracles?
You know, people write dissertations on that, and people argue about that. In my work, I see Hume saying two things that are significant. One would be that he sort of got us thinking about the definition of miracle in a way, and then he's sort of, I would say, the father of this belief that somehow there's something sort of self-contradictory in talking about miracles. So it might go something like this, that a miracle is a violation of a natural law by God, but a violation of natural law is sort of a contradiction in terms because natural laws tell us the way things work. And if a true natural law, and then if there were a counter instance to a natural law, then what we know is it isn't a complete true natural law. So you can't have both the law and the exception by definition. Is part of what Hume, at least a lot of people attribute that to Hume, at least. So I think that's an important point. I think in response, because I'm not interested in just always verbal discussions, but I think in part one key thing would be to say that people like Flew and others who come after Hume have made the point that really what counts against a natural law would be a repeatable instance, not just an instance. Because if you started saying, I mean, there are clearly things that happen that we just don't understand, that have nothing to do with religion or anything, and you wouldn't want to somehow say that those things, you either have to say they didn't occur or the law has to go. If you start having repeatable instances that gravity in some repeatable way didn't hold, or water turned into wine in some repeatable way, or people rose and dead in some repeatable way, then we have a reason really to challenge the law. So I think that's one thing. The other thing would be there that by definition, if, as a matter of fact, let's just assume there is some sort of God and God does intervene in some way, then if God circumvented or intervened, it wouldn't be a violation of the natural law in the sense that the natural law doesn't hold natural circumstances. It would just mean if there's something non-natural involved, then the natural law is not going to hold in that case. So I think that was an interesting point to raise. I don't think that's held so much anymore as a real problem with miracle. But here's the one I think is probably most important, what I hear Hume saying. When I teach this, I try to give Hume his strongest argument here. It has to do with the alleged event itself. So let's separate the event from the cause of the event. So Miss America 1980, Cheryl Pruitt, I think was her name. Heard her once, and she was talking about the fact that she was in an accident and her leg had been crushed and it was malformed in some way, and she went to a healing service and somebody touched her and her leg just went back to its normal shape and size automatically, instantly. So given my distinction, one question would be, did that event really happen? Even if we decided it did, then we have a second question, what would be the cause, whatever it would be. So I think Hume's talking about the event itself here, not God, and sort of says something like this. Look, the laws of nature are uniform laws based on past experience. They can be tested by anybody. You can jump off buildings all you want. You can test gravity, and it will hold. People who talk about miracles and talk about events, usually it's a few people. They aren't repeatable, so that counts against it to start with. Our past experience confirms that religious people or people who have a bias toward wanting something to happen can see that it happens, so you have to be careful there. The wise person proportions belief to her or his evidence, the famous maxim. So you end up that it's always most reasonable to disbelieve the report of the alleged event in that way. So, and I think I raise that with students, and I think that's a valid point. If you say, is it always good to be cautious when anybody makes any claim like that? I think the answer would be yes. If you build out the idea, because that argument is not a religious argument, that has to do, if you build that out, what ultimately, you wouldn't want to sort of say that anyone looking at an event that seemed to go against natural laws should believe the event didn't occur, because the science often goes forward because people do acknowledge the events occur. So Swinburne and others have talked about the fact that conceptually possible, at least, or in practice probably is the case, that sometimes types of evidence can be very strong for an event, something you've experienced yourself, something that has objective criteria based around it, x-rays, things like that. So I guess that and Anthony Flew and others, I think, have backed off a little bit, and I think they would say, boy, you have very good reasons to really doubt when people say alleged miracles occur, because even the event happening, I guess I would say that there's a greater consensus today that would say that stands as a very good reason to be cautious. That might not be a reason to say it couldn't have occurred. So I see those as the two major Humean arguments and sort of, I think, what the responses might be today.
Well, let me put forward the part that I find most important in Hume, and that I read most often in my atheist colleagues, let's say, and that would be this epistemological point about how if we're going to proportion our beliefs to the evidence, then it would seem like it's very difficult for us to have sufficient evidence for a miracle. Let's take your example of the American Beauty Queen. So the problem there is that in our experience and throughout history, legs don't just magically reshape their bones into the right structures and muscles and all this kind of thing just automatically. That just doesn't happen in our experience.
Right.
But what does happen in our experience is that people lie all the time, people exaggerate, our psychology is such that we'll interpret things in a certain way if we believe it to be so, even though it didn't happen that way. Our memories are faulty. Those things are very, very common. But legs restructuring themselves internally to be fixed doesn't happen in our experience. And so it's possible that her report is veridical, that she's reporting exactly what happened, but it's just extremely more likely that one of these other very, very common things happened. And so it might have happened, but it would be nearly impossible for us to know that it happened. Or to say that we have good reason that it happened. Because with a miracle, it's pretty much always going to be the case that explanations like the one I just gave are more likely because they happen all the time and we understand them very well than this totally bizarre and just contradicting with all of our experience thing of the leg restructuring itself.
It seems to me, as I unpack that, there are a couple of things going on there. First, I would want to make sure we were clear on the general epistemological principle we're using here. In other words, so what I wanted to say, it's easy sometimes when you're attacking a specific instance somebody raises, not saying you're doing this, but to miss the general principle. Is the general principle then that let's forget religion? Anybody who says anything such that we say, but we don't have any evidence for that, we should just, I mean, Edward, and I think you're saying, we should say it's extremely unlikely that really happened. Okay. And then I would say that's a perfectly valid thing. I think Swinburne and others would say, apart from anything else, boy, you have to be careful not to go too far with that, because there would just then you'd be getting into issues about different kind of philosophical points, that when you observe something yourself and you try to figure out and parse out the reasons why you may just be in delusional and may want to do it. I mean, if you wanted to, I mean, it seems to me that we probably do give some credence to what we think we view. We certainly give more credence to those people who have proved proportioning beliefs experience to have told us, been truthful when they say they see things. So I just want to make the general point. I'm not trying to defend miracle here. I'm just saying I think that principle sometimes can become problematic scientifically when you try to take it too far, but we could talk more about that. I guess, and this gets into an issue we might talk about later a little bit, about what counts as good evidence or a reasonable perspective. I think talking about any event and an explanation for it outside of the whole context of the explanatory structure or the person's belief is probably going to be complicating in some way. So somebody might say something like this. If a person had reason, justifiable basis for believing, and that we're getting back again to whether people stand in a place where we can say they're objective, neutral criteria. I'm just not in that game very much in lots of areas. We could talk about that later. So I would say, can somebody justifiably believe that there is an entity we might want to call God. And I'm going to say I haven't been convinced that a person couldn't justifiably believe it, which isn't to say at all anybody else has to find that plausible in that sense. And then I would say, if you have that, and then you can say that you feel justified in some way in thinking that you have some information about how that God were to act in the world, then I think what really happens for most theists is they actually don't affirm events as happening unless they see it as part of some divine action pattern that they have reason to believe before makes sense. So I say, for example, what would happen to you if you were on your way back from this class to the dorm and you had decided, for example, somebody said, I decided that I wanted to have a nice lunch today. I didn't want to have to go. So I just prayed to God to give me a nice salad, and right outside my dorm popped up various kinds of vegetables, and I did that. And most of them, just write that off right away because it doesn't fit into a pattern of the way they think God acts. Or, this might be a better example, Robert Swesleyan probably is about 75% Protestant. St. John Fisher here in town is about 75% Catholic and 25% Protestant. My students, who all believe that God can act in the world, just don't have nearly the same kind of confidence in some of the healing waters of words and stuff like that because it's not part of their tradition. So in that sense, I think the argument's good. I guess what I don't quite see is that in my mind, it doesn't hit to the justification of a belief under certain conditions. And I guess it comes down to the burden of proof. If you say, look, I've got reason on my side. I mean, look at it this way. Any rational person would see that I've got reason. You better justify how you can show that yours is rational. I always get a little uneasy about burden of proof discussions. So that's a very generalized answer, but those are the kinds of things I would say.
You've written some on the relationship between miracles and natural explanations. What is it that you've argued in that arena?
When you talk about something being unexplainable naturally, that's a loaded concept. I would say this, for example. If the idea is there could be no fully satisfying, complete natural explanation for the event, then I think if someone defines a miracle by saying it's only a miracle if there couldn't be that, then I think we have to make a distinction right away between what you'd say about that event itself, token, and the event type. By definition, whatever was involved here, I'll speak more about that later, whatever's involved, if you think that it came about in part because God did something, then that event itself doesn't have a fully natural explanation by definition. But I think what people really have in mind is they want to see healings, they want to see things, they want to say, but look, science could never give us a full explanation for that. I think that's dangerous. I don't see how that could be said. And so I think as an event type, we have to be very careful. And I think people who want to say, miracles are those things which science could never explain and give us a natural explanation for or couldn't have with that, I think then you just set yourself up for down the road, maybe there goes your miracle. So I don't think you want to go that way. And that's why I think in the real world, when I actually do interact with real people talking about miracles, the idea of a coincidence miracle is just as strong. So the old famous example that's used would be the one about the child on the railroad track. So there's a child, a hearing-impaired child, who is playing outside. Mom's watching out the window. There's a train track close, and all of a sudden Mom looks up, and the little boy's gone down in the train track, and he's playing on the train track, and there's a bend in the train track before where the little boy's playing. There's some trees there. The train, the engineer's not going to be able to see the boy in time, and the mother can't yell and say, get off the track, Johnny. So all she can do is pray and say, dear God, save my son, and she's astounded to see the train slow down and stop just before the boy. And she goes out, and she's thanking God for the miracle, and she finds out that it was a hot day. The engineer fainted. When he fainted, his hand left the throttle. The brake went on automatically, and it stopped. So we have a natural explanation there. But the event sequencing is such that it looks as if God was involved in some way. So I think probably most real believers on the ground thinking about miracles aren't so interested in whether a natural explanation could be available, or maybe even is in this case. They're more interested in their belief that it wouldn't have happened in this case the way it happened if God hadn't been involved in some way. So I guess I'm trying to say that I think it's complicating to talk about natural laws and miracles, because I think our human knowledge simply couldn't make certain assumptions about that.
So the Christian could still believe that behind the natural explanation of how it happened is some intervention.
Yeah, and I think I would think that would be required for a definition of miracle that was robust. I mean, we use miracle lots of ways. You know, boy, I found something, what a miracle that I got up on time or something like that. But when you talk about a religious miracle, I think almost always what is the claim, which makes it a controversial claim, because epistemologically, and that would be that God was directly involved in some way, this event token itself wouldn't have happened the way it happened exactly if God hadn't been involved in some way. Which raises the second question, that, and Hume gets to this, but not as much as other people have, how would you ever be able to know that God was directly involved? And so there's that second question.
Well, that sounds like a toughie. Do you have any answers for us?
Well, I ask my students this sometimes. Say, give me a conceivable situation, not just anything you conceive of, such that if that were to occur, everyone who was rational would have to agree that there was a God and God was involved. And so they come up with things, and so some student might say something like, well, look, let's say a voice came out of the sky and it said, I'm the God of whatever God you want there, and I'm going to turn off all the natural lights, all the lights, including the natural lights, for 15 minutes. And at that moment, everyone heard that voice around the world, and the lights went off, and we were in total pitch darkness for 15 minutes, and then it came back on. Wouldn't that get people's attention? And the answer to that type of question is yes. Wouldn't then people be required to affirm that God was involved or something like that? And right away, I tell my students who bring something like that up, I say, well, let's say the voice said, I'm Allah. Then I guess you would just become a Muslim. And the answer is no, of course, because every system has in it ways of explaining. For Christians, it might be satanic counterfeiting, something else is going on. So the point would be, I can't imagine personally any conceivable situation such that if were to occur, people would have to grant the causal explanation that there was some kind of deity involved. I think there would always be other self-consistent, naturalistic answer that could be given. That would seem more reasonable given your presuppositions to start with. So, and this is a way of saying, I simply don't think miracle has the apologetical value some people have thought it did, where you can say to others, look at this, look at the miracle, therefore you ought to be a believer because of the miracle. I don't think that's going to work that way in most cases.
Well, David, we've been speaking mostly about issues where we would assume, you know, if God exists, then what are the traits of God? Or if God exists, how can we look at miracles? I wonder if you could present one thought for disbelievers in God to ponder.
Well, I guess, you know, and this is going to come off as not very helpful and abstract, but I'm going to restate what I've said a little bit before. And that is, I guess, I think it would be good for all of us, including atheists, to ponder our what I would call our epistemic condition. I mean, what's the basis upon which we're making pronouncements that lead us to believe that atheism is the most plausible or logical thing to hold? And I would say that for theists, which I do in class all the time. I never give my own opinion in class, and I would probably be known over the last 35 years of teaching as having challenged more theists than they would ever have been challenged theists in ways they've never been challenged at the university, but they would have simply bonded together and protected their faith in some way. So, I mean, I guess I really do think that when you, if you see the position you're in, and I don't think we're in a position where we either are non-question-begging objective criteria for making decisions, I think we find out that there are a number of incompatible, justifiable perspectives on most major issues. In that case, and if someone's there, then I think what we do then is have the kind of discussion where we say to one another, here's some information I have that leads me to see that theism might be a better perspective, and here's the reasons you think that's not the case. We talk about that. We look at each other's positions, make sure we're self-consistent, and then we make a choice that way. So I think that's the wrong way of looking at it. What I would like theists and atheists and agnostics to be would be, I think, sort of friendly discussions, and respectful, not friendly sounds wrong, but respectful discussions in that way. I don't think that's the end isn't that. I think that's the consequent of having epistemic humility. So one of the issues I'm working on now is epistemic humility, which has nothing to do about trying to be differential and not holding your belief firmly. It has to do with understanding the epistemic condition. So I guess I would just urge all of us, including atheists, agnostics, to think about that position carefully, because I think doing that will help us to be able to get into more respectful discussions, generally speaking.
Well, I think I can get behind that completely. Thanks for sharing that. Well, David, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Well, I've enjoyed it, and these are important topics. I always like to be able to discuss them. And again, you know, these are my perspectives. People brighter than I have different perspectives on all of these things, but I think they're issues worthy of discussion. I'm glad you've given a forum for that. Thank you.